Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And I knew that, you know, I probably wasn't going to have a lot of savings. Social Security's not going to pay for everything. What little bit that the nursery will bring in will be a help.
Frank Nikas started regrowing foods he bought from the supermarket out of curiosity. Now he sees a bigger potential for his indoor container garden. We'll hear about the plant that could help revitalize monarch butterfly populations. From Harvest Public Media, the price of commodity crops is still low, but the cost of running a farm is very high. We hear how farmers are stretching their budgets to make it work. Two recipes for pesto, neither of which contain any basil or pine nuts. And then Vicky Bassman tells stories of the food from Pearl Lagoon, Nicaragua. A brief news update this week. Here's Mark Chilla.
It's going to take a lot of money to woo the world's largest supplier of genetically modified seeds, more than $62 billion. Multinational pharmaceutical company giant Bayer AG found that out the hard way this week after their hefty offer was rejected by agrochemical giant Monsanto. Monsanto CEO and Chairman Hugh Grant called Bayer's bid incomplete and financially inadequate. Bayer says it will continue to pursue Monsanto, and Monsanto says they are open to further negotiations with the pharmaceutical company. If all goes according to previous trends, Bayer would abandon the Monsanto name after the purchase, giving Monsanto a clearer path to overcoming public backlash against their genetically modified seeds. Bayer would also become the world's largest supplier of seeds and agricultural chemicals. The CDC announced earlier this month that a listeria outbreak spurred a frozen food company to recall 358 products. Investigators say the source is likely CRF frozen foods, where damaged equipment could have allowed the bacteria to contaminate products. The company first recalled products made from February 1st to the 19th this year, but has expanded the end date to April 21st. Concerns about listeria have also cropped up in the UK, where Costco expanded a recall last week to include a brand of veggie burgers and a frozen vegetable mix. And there are two new lines on food labels to keep an eye out for. On beef products, the phrases mechanical tenderizing and blade tenderized mean the meat has been punctured to break down the muscle fibers and make it easier to chew. But it also means the meat has a greater chance of being contaminated. And on processed foods, there's now a line on nutrition labels that tell you how much added sugar is in the product. We posted pictures of the labels on our website. Several other food news stories to read there as well at eartheats.org.
Great. Thanks, Mark.
See you soon.
After several boom years, while the rest of the economy struggled, farming is entering its third straight year on the bust side of the cycle. Corn and soybean and other commodity prices are low, while expenses like seed, fertilizer, and land remain high. And that means farmers have to get creative to succeed. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
Modern crop farms in the Midwest are sophisticated businesses, so farmers managing them in tough times are reviewing business school basics.
We like to look at farming as we build commodities, and every individual acre is a unique production facility.
That's David Muth, who runs AgSolver in Ames, Iowa, one of many data-driven startups promising to make farms more efficient. Muth compares each acre of a farm to one store in a chain of coffee shops. Some locations are profitable, others not so much.
The question we like to ask is, would we be satisfied if any one of those individual production facilities is operating at a loss?
Probably not, he says. So what do you do with the coffee shops that are losing money? Any MBA will tell you to do two things: reduce expenses and stop wasting money. Let's start with that second one. Andrew Heineman is driving his old pickup to a bright green field with shoots taller than any corn at this time.
Here they are.
This young farmer graduated from Iowa State University in 2013, just in time to return to his family's Boone County farm as the agriculture economy started to tank. This year he's planted about 150 acres of oats, a crop not seen on this corn-soybean farm in his lifetime. This past winter, he consulted with one of those data analysis firms.
Found out this was kind of one of our lower profit farms. So we're trying to figure out a way to kind of offset kind of the stuff from $3 corn.
Oats are risky, but Heinemann ran his idea past Iowa State Extension agronomist Mark Johnson, who told him,
"This would be a great year to try to raise them if you've got a market."
Now, back to the other business school lesson, cut costs. After land, seed is the biggest expense on a crop farm. Modern seeds are packed with special traits that protect them from insects or fungus or make them herbicide tolerant. Johnson says in the good years, the extra expense was cheap insurance. Now, he says, farmers could cut seed cost in half if they dropped all the traits.
You know, most guys are going to only ratchet back some traits, and so maybe they're only going to save 25% or 20%. But still, today's corn, that's still a pretty good chunk of money.
We're talking thousands, maybe tens of thousands of dollars. Ryan Brisley farms about 20 miles southeast of Heinemann.
You take a little bit of a gamble when you try to reduce some things, but we did reduce some of our traits.
He's also using a nitrogen calculator that Iowa State has developed. He plugs in his location, the expected corn price, and the cost of fertilizer to find out just how much to use. Brisley will apply less than usual this year because a small bump from extra fertilizer won't generate enough additional corn to pay for itself. But he's cautious.
You don't want to do it where it's detrimental to your yield, because at the end of the day, yield is still king, and that's what's going to drive your return.
Here's one more savings tip. Make do. Brisley's maneuvering a huge red herbicide sprayer. It's not new. He and his family are repairing rather than replacing equipment. One side benefit of a rough farm economy, both state and federal officials are seeing more interest in conservation programs. Andrew Heinemann drives back to his shop where his uncle and 92-year-old grandfather are working. He says the older generations are helping him navigate the lousy farm economy.
They say ag comes, it goes in cycles, and then you just kind of got to prepare for some of the bad times and the good, and then be able to ride it out and come back up.
That optimism is the hallmark of an entrepreneur, from Silicon Valley to the Iowa prairie. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Vicki Bassman is the Chief of Interpretation for Indiana State Parks and Reservoirs. She first traveled to the Pearl Lagoon Basin of Nicaragua 8 years ago to teach sustainable tourism workshops to the people living in that isolated part of the Atlantic coast. She fell in love with the people, the culture, and the food. Her cookbook highlights all those aspects of her time in Pearl Lagoon, with the stories paired with photographs and traditional recipes. I spoke with Bassman in 2013. What I noticed flipping through the book, the recipes and the stories really flow together. It's almost like the food is sort of the main character in the storytelling, and the people come and go and they change, but the food is what we're focusing on.
Absolutely. I think that any interpreter in this country, whether they work at the Park Service or for state parks or county parks, when you think of someone who is interpreting a resource, the good ones are storytellers, and they find the intangibles, the things that make the resource come alive. So when I conceived of this book idea, yes, I'd fall in love with the baked goods, and I was trying to find a sustainable tourism product that the people could sell. They really, for the tourists that do get to Pearl Lagoon, there's very little for them to buy and take home to remember their trip. So I thought, let's write these recipes down, and people could take home, both in a written format and photography-wise and story-wise, a memory of their trip. And they could go home and make coconut rice and beans and remember the flavor of the trip. So it all just felt like a package that worked together.
You ran into a problem that we run into all the time when we work with chefs. They rarely, if ever, use a measuring cup. And you ran into that problem, too, when you went into people's homes and into restaurants. So talk about trying to create recipes out of these dishes that are really just created by feel.
Right. I never saw a single recipe book being used, and I never saw a single measuring instrument being used, especially when they were the women making large quantities of baked goods because they took them to the cooperatively owned bakeries and sold them. They would make hundreds of journey cakes at a time. They would make hundreds of toto. They would make hundreds of coconut bread. And so to them, it was amusing that somebody would want to come and watch them and try and write it down. I guessed at quantities. I was lucky that I was able to take my then 17-year-old daughter, Emma, with me. And so I had somebody to kind of confer with, you know, did that look like a tablespoon? Did that look like a teaspoon?
Oh, my gosh.
I couldn't even ask the women or the men making the recipe because they don't use tablespoons or teaspoons. So it meant nothing to them if I were to even ask them, was that about a teaspoon? They'd say,
what's that?
Yeah, Miss Vicky, it was just a pinch. You know, I would get that comment all the time. So coming home and reproducing the recipes, we did the best we could. But one of my strongest sentences in the book is adjust to your own taste. That's what they did. That's what I had to do. And that's what I hope people who try these recipes will do.
We're going to talk about Johnny Cakes in just a moment. But the beet drink, simple as can be, beets, sugar, lime juice, and orange juice to taste. That's all there is to it.
Yeah.
So simplicity is the name of the game?
Simplicity is always the name of the game. And that was an interesting day because the woman who was cooking that day, Miss Arlene, was – she had welcomed us into her home. She had planned a meal. But I could tell as it was being put together, two things happened. One, she had a daughter who was in an adjacent bedroom who was about 8 months pregnant and not feeling well. And so Miss Arlene was creating a meal more to take care of her daughter than to take care of tourists, which was really a wonderful opportunity to see. And that beet drink was something she just threw together because she felt like, this is what my daughter needs. I had never had a, you know, beets prepared in both a drink and a salad so easily and so quickly. Mm-hmm. It was delicious.
Yeah, it looks really good. Okay, so Johnny Cakes, we got to get to this. Basic ingredients, some sort of fat, salt, sugar, flour, and then one recipe uses coconut milk. The other one uses the trash from coconut.
Yeah. Coconut, which is in almost all the foods. The men or the women take the coconut. They chop off the ends with a machete, holding the coconut in their hand, and they take off the brown outer husk. Then they put a large grater. It's about 2 foot long. And real quickly, they grate the coconut with the what's left of the brown husk and then the white meat. And, of course, all of the milk comes out at the same time. So in the bowl, then, is all of that mash. And then they add some water and they squeeze and squeeze and squeeze. Then they pour it through a strainer. So what you end up with, that's your coconut milk. Then if they want to take some handfuls of the grated mash that's left behind and throw that in, they call that the trash. And I love the journey cakes or the toto when they would put the trash in because it just gave a really good texture. I always asked them to keep the trash in.
You can try making Johnny Cakes yourself. The recipe is on our website, eartheats.org. Vicki Bassman is the Chief of Interpretation for Indiana State Parks and Reservoirs. Her book is Pearls from the Lagoon, Short Stories and Recipes. Coming up, special guest Arlen Llewellyn blends up some carrot tops. Then Daniel Orr's take on an out-of-the-ordinary pesto.
Now, a lot of people think of pesto as being that classic basil pesto that's so famous in Italian cooking. Grind up the garlic and then work in the basil or the different herbs and then add some cheese and some pine nuts. But you can make pestos out of a lot of different things.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
Earth Eats here. I'm Annie Corrigan. Arlen Llewellyn in the kitchen at Function Brewing.
So pesto, as you may know, is an amazing base recipe because it's a simple ratio of ingredients, and you can substitute almost any aspect of those out. So you can use almost any leafy vegetable for the basil. You can use almost any form of acid for the lemon juice, any form of nut for the pine nuts that are traditionally in it.
This recipe came out of her partnership with Jim Bauman of Freedom Valley Farm.
And we were talking to him about carrots, and he said, well, do you want to do anything with the tops? Because I've got a bunch of those. And I looked at him, and he's like, they make a great pesto. And it turns out that's a whole thing, but I didn't know anything about that.
Yes, yes, you can eat carrot greens. She substituted the tops into her basic pesto recipe, along with some other substitutions, and it turned out so great. Here's the recipe.
So we use aged Gouda instead of Parmesan. We use that in a couple different components in our recipes in-house, and I think it makes a great addition to pesto. And cashews, which we use instead of pine nuts. I would hold off on adding any of the oil because you really want this hard stuff to be forced to be broken down by the food processor blade. If you start adding oil in there, it's just going to swim around the blade rather than being broken down. All right, I'm going to start grinding this up, pulsing it. Adding the oil in. So that's the reason for the handy little hole at the top of the food processor, is to be able to do something like this. Also, how you would do, for instance, mayonnaise, is to just stream it in very slowly.
This carrot top pesto found a home on Function's Wood Nymph Panini, which has roasted carrots, collard greens, and two types of cheeses. Arlen Llewellyn is a master at constructing sandwiches. See the recipe and the photo of this unbelievable panini on our website. Another take on pesto with Daniel Orr, the perk of meeting him at his mom's house in Columbus, Indiana, is that he can walk into the front yard garden and pluck ingredients right from the plants. And that's what he did for this recipe.
Well, today I'm going to take some mint and do a mint pesto, which is going to have a little bit of an Asian-inspired flavor by adding some ginger to it. All right, so the best way to get started is to throw your garlic in there first. Garlic tends to take a little longer to puree than the rest, so if you add it towards the end, it might stay a little chunky and you'll get big pieces of it in there. I'm going to add a little bit of lemon zest, about a tablespoon of ginger. I'm going to add a half a jalapeno in here and leave the seeds in. And I'm going to put in, a good 3 or 4 cups of mint. And I've just pulled off the tops of the mint, so we don't have any real tough stems in here. All right, a little bit of salt and some oil. Now, I'm going to use some nice extra virgin olive oil in this. We're just going to puree this. And it's really just as simple as that.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that good?
Very tasty.
So you could throw that with pasta. You could make it into a salad dressing. A great thing to do with this also, just pour it into plastic containers or jars, put it in the freezer, and, we'll keep for months in the freezer. Now, with a lot of traditional pestos, you do add some Parmesan cheese and nuts. Now, I've left this one completely vegan, and so there's a lot more uses for it. And then if you want to add the cheese, you can just add it at the time you're going to use it.
Follow these recipes at eartheats.org. Pulling up to Frank Nikas's house, you can tell he's a gardener. His yard is full of raised beds and rows of last year's crops. When I visited in early March, he hadn't yet started his preparations for spring planting because it had been too cold and even a bit snowy. But inside his house, that was a different story. His living room is jam-packed with plants on shelves, and I mean floor to ceiling. This is the ultimate indoor container garden. There's lemongrass and sprouting quinoa, some sunchokes. Those aren't so unusual. It's the small tree over there by the sliding door that's really caught my attention.
Yeah, this is a coffee tree.
He pulls a red cherry off a branch to reveal 2 small coffee beans.
He grew this from a cutting he received from a coworker, which makes the coffee tree different from almost everything else growing in here. Like the ginger and beets and lemongrass, most of these plants were started from food he bought at the grocery store. He planted the carrots and the celery the same way.
But all you got to do is just leave, I left, maybe 3-4 inches. And then you just stick it right in the dirt.
And eventually you'll get new celery ribs popping up. The carrots will just grow more greens, but those are edible. The pots with the lettuce aren't looking so good.
Now the problem with lettuce is that once it's large enough to go into the grocery store, a lot of times it's ready to go into the bloom cycle.
Which means you won't get a lot of new growth, but there are a few new shoots that could be plucked for a tiny salad. It's obvious that this has grown far beyond a simple hobby, but it all started because of one thing.
It's just curiosity.
And curiosity has fueled him since he was young.
I remember when I was a kid, my grandmother put a stick in the ground, just a plain old stick, to prop up her tomatoes, and the stick grew.
One day, it had leaves. Around that same time, he got the idea to plant food from the grocery store. First experiment, grapefruit seeds.
And we cut into it, and it had sprouting seeds in it for some reason. And I'm old. They didn't have packaged dirt back then, so I went out in the garden, got some dirt, and planted them up. And I had a tree for well over 20 years.
Changes come slowly in Frank's garden, and he seems to like it that way. But he's starting to think about his end game. In the coming years, he says he'll be relying on his container garden to fill the gaps in his income.
And I knew that, you know, I probably wasn't going to have a lot of savings, and Social Security's not going to pay for everything. And what little bit that the nursery will bring in will be a help.
He sees possibilities with the giant tubs of ginger. He dumps them out, dirt and all, to show me the biggest tangle of ginger root I've ever seen.
Oh, you didn't see the ginger? Oh. Well, I didn't.
Sure enough.
I didn't.
There's no way he could eat all of this. So he's giving some of it away, and maybe he'll also make some money off it. This is the result of 6 years of growth, and it all started with a tiny toe of ginger he bought from the store. And, of course, some curiosity.
And if it doesn't work, you know, it was waste anyway. It was going to go in the compost, so why not, you know, see what happens.
Last pot to show me is in the kitchen, one of his newest plantings that has taken him full circle. It's a tiny grapefruit plant. Thanks to Frank Nikas for showing me around his indoor gardening paradise. I snapped some pictures and have shared those on the website, eartheats.org. Tweet us shots of your container garden. We're at Earth Eats. Monarch butterflies are disappearing. There's a consensus among scientists that populations of the black and orange insect are in decline, but there's much less certainty on what's causing them to vanish. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon has more.
Bob Trout.
Hey, Bob. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, sir.
Bob Trout is decked out in a bright orange jacket, working along the banks of the Big Thompson River in Loveland, Colorado. Trout is a big fan of monarchs.
They're gorgeous. They are just absolutely gorgeous butterfly caterpillars. And the chrysalis with the jade green with the gold dots around the rim are just fantastic looking.
Today, he's in charge of a team of volunteers out here on a windy, rainy morning to plant the river's banks with milkweed, held in small plastic containers. They're using hammers and stakes to make holes in the hard-packed soil. Milkweed is a food source for the caterpillars that eventually, of course, turn into butterflies. It's all they feed on, and Trout's hope is that by planting more, monarchs will thrive in this migration corridor.
We're trying to save the migration is what we're trying to do.
Every spring, hundreds of thousands of monarch butterflies sweep across the Great Plains, from Mexico to Canada, and then back again in the fall. It's an amazing journey, one that takes place over multiple generations for the butterflies. It takes 4 generations to head north, and the final one flies all the way back to Mexico to spend the winter. But for the last 20 years, fewer and fewer butterflies are making the trek.
We don't really know what is causing the monarchs to
to be going down in population size.
Hide Inamine is an evolutionary biologist at Cornell University. For years, scientists have been trying to find the pinch point for monarchs. Just where in the migration are they losing ground?
Monarch caterpillars feed exclusively on milkweed plants, so people always thought that the decline in milkweed is causing the decline in monarch butterflies.
But that's not really the case. Itamine and a team of researchers found that most of the decline is happening when the butterflies turn around in Canada to head back south, no longer reliant on milkweed. When the butterflies are fully grown, they can feed on other plants. And so far, scientists haven't been able to show that disappearing milkweed is causing the caterpillars to starve.
We don't really know what is causing the decline per se, but what we can say is that it's happening when they're migrating down south to Mexico.
Previous studies have pointed the finger at Midwest farmers for destroying milkweed and planting corn with an insecticide bred into the kernels. But more recent studies paint a larger picture, suggesting a combination of habitat fragmentation, severe weather, climate change, disease, and deforestation is to blame.
We always look for simple solutions or simple blame.
Katie Savinelli is in charge of pollinator stewardship for the agrochemical giant Syngenta. She's part of a group of conservationists, ag companies, and farm groups. They're trying to restore and protect some habitat in the Midwest to provide more milkweed and nectar plants to boost monarchs as they migrate north and south. She says farmers have been receptive to keeping more butterfly habitat intact, but it's taken some convincing.
In the case of milkweed, after telling them for the past 30 years you need to eliminate it, now we're saying bring it back. And so there's going to be some learning for sure.
Back on the banks of the Big Thompson River in Loveland, Mary Pullen and her son Nick Balla are pulling tiny milkweed plants from their containers and placing them in the ground.
Only a few months ago, I heard about the milkweed issue in relation to the monarchs for the first time, and it seemed like that was something that the normal everyday Joe could do.
Even if milkweed isn't the likely pinch point, scientists say planting more of it could give populations a boost as they travel north across the Great Plains. Pullen says while scientists argue about where and when monarchs are being hurt during their migration, she'll be doing her part to help the migratory butterflies.
Very small thing, but it could end up being a big thing with a lot of people doing little things.
And the act of doing many small things, from scientists, concerned citizens, and farmers, could be exactly what it takes to keep monarch populations from dwindling even further. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Connect with these food and farming reporters at harvestpublicmedia.org. Thanks to Luke Runyon and Amy Mayer for their good work today. Shoutouts also to Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Daniel Orr, and Betsy Shepard. The executive producer of Earth Eats is John Bailey. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Hard to believe that was the last show for the month of May. Thanks so much for tuning in to hear it. I'm Annie Corrigan.